Good afternoon and a very warm welcome to the German Historical Institute to yet another event on the First World War. At the moment, I think there is about a book a day on the First World War and probably events every second day, at least in London. But this one is a very special event because unlike all the others who present all the knowledge about the First World War and what historians have over the past century found out about the origins of the First World War, this event will focus on the everything we don't know. So welcome to this afternoon's panel debate. And my name is Andreas Gestrich. I'm the director, and I will step aside in a second, but not without thanking particularly Mark Jürgensen and Felix Römer, who have organized this event. Mark Jürgensen is from UCL, and Felix Römer is here from the Institute. And I'm very grateful to you both that you've brought together a very eminent panel, which Mark is going to introduce in a second. Mark himself has worked extensively on the First World War, and yes, I'm looking greatly forward to the interesting debate you will have amongst each other, and then afterwards also there's the possibility for questions and answers. You'll open the debate to the floor. Very few things. We try to leave the windows open for a bit because otherwise the air gets very bad in this room. If it's too noisy and the loudspeaker, we can either put the loudspeakers up or close the windows. Please make yourself known if it's acoustically difficult. And afterwards, you're all very welcome to join us for a reception, which will take place downstairs for some wine and further talks. So, without much ado, I would like to hand over to Mark Jürgensen to introduce the panelists. So, thank you all very much for coming, and thank you, Mark and Felix, for organizing this.
Well, welcome to our roundtable on the causes of the First World War, kindly hosted by the German Historical Institute and co-sponsored, I've got to say this, by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. Its format will consist of 4 10-minute papers by our panellists, followed by a discussion of the panellists amongst themselves relating to any questions which come up during the opening statements, and then followed finally by questions from the audience. The emphasis on the roundtable, as Professor Gestrich has said, will be on outstanding gaps in our knowledge of and in persisting and open questions about the causes of the war. Open questions which, it could be argued, have often been lost sight of in this year's abundant crop of radio programmes and especially television documentaries, which are perhaps ill-suited to an examination of historical controversy, preferring, in many instances, perhaps not all, the certainties of a good story or an historical narrative. We are, I think, very fortunate tonight to have 4 of the principal experts working on the causes of the First World War to outline what they consider to be the main points of persisting contention concerning the outbreak of the conflict. Firstly, Professor John Rill. This is the order in which they're going to give the statements, not the order in which they're sitting. Professor John Rill from the University of Sussex is the author of a myriad of works on the domestic and foreign policy of Imperial Germany, including Germany Without Bismarck, The Crisis of Government in the Second Reich, 1890 to 1900, which came out in 1967, and which many of us working on this topic grew up with. The Kaiser and His Court, Wilhelm and the Governments of Germany from 1994, and of course the definitive 3-volume biography of Wilhelm II, the last part of which has just been published in English by Cambridge University Press this year. He's joined by Professor Zunker Neitzel from LSE, who's published important works on combat in the First and Second World Wars, most recently a best-selling and very well-received volume entitled Soldaten, based on British and American secret recordings of the conversations of German prisoners of war. And he's also published extensively on diplomacy in Germany and Europe before the First World War, notably Weltmacht oder Untergang, Die Weltreichslehre im Zeitalter des Imperialismus, so on theories of world empire in the period of imperialism, which came out in 2000, and a work on Kriegsausbruch, Deutschlands Weg in die Katastrophe, which came out in 2002. Professor Neitz will be followed by Dr. Annika Mombauer from the Open University, who's the author of a seminal operational and political biography of Germany's Chief of the General Staff, entitled Helmut von Moltke and the Origins of the First World War, which came out in 2001. And she's also the author of the principal examination of the historiography of the causes of the First World War, entitled The Origins of the First World War, Controversies and Consensus, which came out in the following year. More recently, she's published, this month or last month? I can't remember.
Today.
Coffee's available. She's the author of An Analysis of the July Crisis, published by Beck and on the shelves now. Finally, we have Professor Margaret McMillan, who is the warden of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, where she's also a professor of international history. She's the author of a series of acclaimed works, including Women of the Raj, published in 1988, Seize the Hour, When Nixon Met Mao, in 2006, and more specifically on the topic relating to the talks today, Peacemakers, the Paris Conference of 1919 and its attempt to end war in 2001, and last year, The War That Ended Peace, How Europe Abandoned Peace for the First World War, which was published by Random House, Profile Books and Penguin. All our speakers tonight have published pioneering works on the causes of the Great War, and it will be a great interest, I think, to hear them say a few words about what they, or historians in general, or let's face it, other historians, still don't know about the causes of the First World War. Thank you. So I'll pass over to Professor Rubin.
Thank you very much, Mark. And thank you very much for inviting me to speak. Do you have to go up there? Really? Okay. Well, I thought this was a microphone. Silly me. It's not exactly a paper that I have, as was advertised just a moment ago. In fact, I want to start on a rather doleful note, because it seems to me that we as historians have failed the public in coming to an answer as to why this horrible catastrophe in 1914, 100 years ago, failed. We failed. We've not provided them with the guidance. Actually, I think at the moment we, in spite of all the dozens of books that are appearing, we seem in some ways to be travelling backwards rather than forwards at the moment. We seem to be forgetting rather than building on what we knew, things that were common currency among historians just 10 years ago are now no longer in the debate. The result of this failure seems to me to be that the publics in different countries are leaving us behind. They are not listening to us because we're not giving a clear message. And they are falling back into national stereotypes in many ways. The British seem to have given up on, the British public, I mean, on the actual causes of the war. There's confusion. If you look at the BBC programmes, which have been mentioned, the only way they could actually present on BBC the cause of the First World War was by having two contradictory programmes, one fronted by Max Hastings, saying it was the Germans' fault, and another one fronted by Neil Ferguson, saying it was nobody's fault, and Britain should never have entered the war. And anyway, his grandfather was in the Scottish regiment, which suffered four times as many losses as any other regiment, as incidentally was my grandfather, my British grandfather. Fought from 1915 to 1918 on the Western Front. Why have we not been able to provide clear guidance after 100 years of scholarship? And this brings me to the question of what we would like to know, what I would like to know. It is my conviction, my personal conviction, and I've said this in many writings, is that there was a German intention to begin a war against France and Russia, not against Britain, in July 1914, according to a plan, silly plan, that went horribly wrong for Germany as well as everybody else. So, but I base this on what I think is very strong evidence, but very slender evidence. And that leads me to the question, well, why is the evidence, if I'm right, so slender? And immediately I come back to the question, to the issue of the manipulation and indeed destruction of sources, especially by the Foreign Office of the Weimar Republic in the 1920s and 1930s in its fight against the war guilt clause of the Treaty of Versailles. And this is not just something that went on in the 1920s, 1930s. I won't even speak about the 12 years in between, but actually went on for some time after 1945 as well. And I mentioned just one or two examples there. The Müller diary, Admiral von Müller's diary, which is actually the best, I think, source that we have for my view of how the war broke out. But that was published in the early 1960s in such an adulterated form that many of the false quotations from that are still being used today to deny the view that I adhere to. And then secondly, I'd like to mention Kurt Rietzler's diary. Kurt Rietzler was the amanuensis of Chancellor von Bethmann-Hollweg, who kept a diary, 50 volumes of it. Lo and behold, the first 30 volumes, it's always the years 1911 to 1914 that disappear. Those 30 volumes were destroyed. There was a text in the published diary purporting to come to cover the weeks, July, August 1914. But there's been a huge controversy about that particular text, and you'll be interested to know, those of you who read German, that in 5 days' time, in the new number of the Historische Zeitschrift, there'll be a new edition, a critical edition, by Bernd Sösemann of those 5 weeks, showing not only that there were some reading mistakes, some transcription mistakes, but also that the document is clearly an apologetic document written, admittedly, by Rietzler, but many years after July 1914. So not a diary written in the situation of the time, but something that was written for other purposes at some later date. So, in a word, I've had my 10 minutes, I'm sure. All I want to say is that what I would like to see, what is still missing, is more evidence of intentionality to bolster my theory, but that's not just for personal reasons, but because I believe it to be the truth.
So, I'm rather long. well, I try to keep it short, and we can have a discussion on every statement then afterwards, especially on the very interesting question, why possibly even every generation, every cohort has a new reading of that. But what we don't know. I mean, I think there are two levels to discuss. There are a lot of key issues, key moments, especially in the July crisis, key moments where we have no sufficient documents on. So, for example, starting with the assassination, the key question, to which degree was the Serbian government involved? I just had lunch with a Serbian colleague at LSE of mine. He said, well, it had nothing to do with Serbia at all. Also, the Black Hand was not involved. You know, Franz Ferdinand had many opponents, and it's nothing to do with Serbia. And you know that there are other explanations on the market. But the big question still, to me at least, is what did Nikola Pašić, for example, know? What did he had any suggestions about that? That is a key issue. The other classical key issues, Poincaré in St. Petersburg, what really happened in St. Petersburg, what words did he use? We have a guess, but we still do not know exactly. Then, and Professor Röhl mentioned that, also I think, to my understanding, Bethmann-Hollweg is a key figure
for the July crisis, for the German side. And if you visit Hohenfino in Berlin, it's worth going there. His grave is still there. And if you see the surrounding, and if you have Riesler's published diary notes on that, it's still the big question, what was really Bethmann Hollweg's intention? What was Riesler, or Riesler writing after the war? And it would, of course, be great to have the big diary of Bethmann Hollweg, the Bethmann Hollweg's Kissinger memorandum and his explanation, his grand strategy. We possibly will never know, but so we can have plausible or non-plausible explanations, but still, to my understanding, Bethmann Hollweg is quite important as a chancellor. So, and how could we explain somebody who began his chancellery definitely not in pushing towards the war, at least to my understanding, more something like a Weltpolitik und kein Krieg, and then towards a risk policy and jump into the dark. Again, we cannot operate with possibility, and we might have explanations for that, but it's we are not very sure. So this is, and we can find, identify other key moments where we want to be, you know, an eyewitness, and what did they really exchange. This is one level. The other level, I think, is a more general thing, and it's a more general problem of historians working on such a key issue. I mean, we have thousands of, even sometimes I have the impression of millions of books and articles on that topic, but still it's a problem with the general conclusions. And this is, I think, that's what we are arguing about. So we can agree, yes, this is the document, but what is the general conclusion? So, for example, what about the Germans, the Russians, or even subgroups, the French diplomats or the German generals, on a limited number of cases? I mean, we all know that, for example, Stieg Förster tried very hard to demonstrate that the German generals did not believe in a short war, but in a long war. But in the end, he somehow failed, because there is some evidence that some generals believe that, but you can't say that everyone or even a majority. So then Stieg, of course, argued that there are these important ones. The other, they don't count. And this is a classical problem what we have as historians working with that. We find evidence for our interpretation, or master narrative, if you want, but there's other evidence, and in the end, we must come up with a theory or a conclusion, and that's a problem, I think. I mean, I've argued in a recent article in the Historische Zeitschrift that I think, but it's more a guess, that the majority of the German diplomats perceived war as an option, as a likely option, a good option, to achieve access to the exclusive club of world powers. So I find some evidence on chatter on the floors of the Wilhelmstrasse. But we have about 300, 400 high-ranking diplomats. Of course, I had not from everyone a diary. And so it's a guess in the end. You could even demonstrate evidence exactly against that. That diplomats say, no, war is not an option. So what do we do with that? Because the public, you possibly, and others say, well, the German diplomats would be interesting. What is their understanding of the situation? And it would be very interesting to know what the diplomatic corps on the whole suggested. If they really suggested, no, I mean, let's fight. We have no diplomatic option at all, and we are in the dead end. So that's the problem. We have a narrow basis of sources, of good sources, but we have in almost no case really representative samples. And I also studied social science. I mean, there I would say, forget it. I mean, if you have one sample, forget it. It proves nothing. And everyone working on the field, I think, is confronted with that problem. And this is also one reason for ongoing debates, because for every evidence in one direction, there's possibly other evidence for the other argument. And then comes the general narrative. So unfortunately, we don't have any opinion polls. We don't have unlimited access to secret archives in a remote tunnel in the Caucasus or something like that. And so we will possibly never know for sure what even the majority of German diplomats or German generals thought about something like a grand strategy, or if they even thought about a grand strategy, if they had even that level of reflection. And one way of at least minimizing the problem is, I think, a careful international comparison on such topics as important topics as militarism. And I find it very difficult. I mean, we have approaches, and Alan Kramer is here in the room. I have approaches of comparison, but there's some research saying, you know, the Germans were special in that way. There is a specific German culture, a German footprint, where others say, well, no, it's a more general European phenomenon. I have no conclusion yet, and to say for something like European or German militarism, is it something special? Should we? Is it really something like a German Sonderweg and that particular issue, or is it more something which is maybe different but not that different? And of course, this is important to answer these kinds of questions. Another key issue is the likelihood, and a big one of the big questions, the war guilt question or responsibility question. The other question is the likelihood of the outbreak of a great war. And with Mommsen and others, there was the opinion it was rather likely that the war would break out in summer 14 or in summer 15 or something like that, because the international relations were in a rather sorrow state of affairs. Then we had, since the last 10 years or so, other interpretations by Kiesling, Holger Afflerbach, Chris Clark, and possibly this is the overwhelming majority now, saying, it was rather unlikely. Europe sleepwalked into the war, and so we were back with Lloyd George, so we had a big circle in the end, in a way. Or Holger Afflerbach had this edited collection with David Stevenson that it was unlikely. Stick first, it was summer. It was just a lucky shot, some things like that. And you could say, well, it doesn't matter, we know that the war broke out, but I think it's very important to answer that question. And we have to, and I'm very old-fashioned to admit, and I think it was rather likely that the war broke out, but I think I'm in a minority opinion here. But again, we are confronted with the question of representativeness on various levels. So what is representative for the time? The peace movement in Germany? The Alldeutsche, the Pan-German League, and also on the level of policymakers and diplomats. So I think we are in Britain, so we can do this. Is what happened if questions. I think it's very important to determine the frame we are working in. For me, it's the what we don't know, one of the most interesting questions of history. What would have happened if Gravido Princip had missed the Archduke on the 28th of June 1914? The First World War anyway, possibly in 16 or 17, or no major war at all, instead a century of peace and prosperity. Of course, we will never know. But to me, this is really one of the key riddles of history, but maybe we need a time machine to answer that question. Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much.
I'm not quite as tall, so I'll just do that. Can you hear me at the back? Thank you ever so much for the kind invitation. It's really a great pleasure to be here and to take part in this discussion. When I thought about the topic, what do we not know, I thought, well, one thing that surely everybody does when they don't know is they Google it. So I tried to Google, what do we not know about the First World War? It didn't work. Clearly nobody has ever, you know when you type in half of a question and the rest gets completed, nobody has ever put that in. Didn't get me anywhere, so that unfortunately didn't help. Now I think until recently, thanks to the mountains of evidence that we have and the 100-year truth-finding campaign that's behind us, we seem to really know everything about the origins of the First World War. I don't think there's much left that we don't know. And I want to just very briefly quote from Walter Hubatsch, who wrote in 1955, I'll quote it in German and then in English. He wrote in 1955, a German historian, "Die Geschichte der Jahre 1914 bis 1918 ist so gut durchforscht wie kaum eine andere Epoche. Der Historiker bewegt sich überall auf sicherem Boden." So the history of the years 1914 to 1918 is as well researched as no other epoch, and the historian, at that point still just a male historian, moves everywhere on certain ground. This was 1955. Now, obviously, 50 years later, to us, that appears somewhat naive. The history of the First World War and its origins has changed fundamentally, or rather how we research and write that history has changed fundamentally. In Hubacz's day, it was still essentially politically political history bottom down. It was very much looking at the diplomats rather than at the people who actually went to war. So how we study the war and its origins today is very different. We focus on personal experiences, the home front, gender, social history, cultural history. Now, how Hubacz saw the origins of the war and the war itself was, of course, revised soon after he published that statement with the Fischer controversy. But I think until recently, many people would nonetheless have claimed that the debate after the Fischer controversy had kind of run its course was settled. The ground, I think, was certain again until quite recently. I think there was really not a lot left to argue about. And when I thought of this, I remembered when I set out doing my PhD, I talked to one of the professors at my university. I said, oh, I'm really interested in this debate. That's what I want to do. And he just said, oh, that old chestnut. So I don't think anyone would say that right now. So who could have predicted then that we would be revisiting this debate in fundamental ways in 2014, that ground had really opened up again, nowhere more so than in Germany, where the current debate is really in many ways reminiscent of the Fischer controversy. So what do we not know? That was my topic, and when I thought about it, I thought, well, actually it fits on the back of a stamp. I haven't quite fitted it on the back of a stamp, but I've fitted it on here. Stamps are so expensive now, aren't they? So this was better. So I have, I think, 4 points of what we do not yet know. My first point is that actually everything is known, that there are no surprises in terms of the documentary evidence. We've already heard about that, and as John said, the evidence for some aspects is slender. That may be so, but there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that historians can mine and have mined, and they can indeed construct almost any interpretation that they want, which is the point that Zünke just made. But what we don't know really is how to agree on that interpretation. So that's my first point, that we have all this evidence, but somehow we cannot find agreement. And as John said, we have in that sense failed. Now, the second point is that we don't know how this debate will develop. As I said, 20 years ago, it seemed there was no debate, and currently it is a really hotly debated topic. So what I don't know and what I wonder about is whether we will still be arguing about this in future. At what point will we actually stop to care? At what point do the origins of the war actually become history? My third point is that the documents, the many, many documents, tell us how decisions were made and how what happened, but they don't tell us why. And I think we still don't know, really, why people made the decisions that they did. What were the war aims? What did people want to achieve with these decisions? Why did they ignore the many warnings? It was not that everybody thought this war would be over by Christmas. Many people thought it would be a long war. It would be the end of European civilization. And yet, they made those decisions. Well, why? I think that's another open question. And my fourth point here is concerns the lessons that we can draw from these events for today. I find that a really difficult question. I mean, people who work on this topic in the last few months have been interviewed quite a lot by newspapers and radio stations, and that question almost invariably comes up, and my heart sinks because it's a question that I don't really know how to answer. What are the lessons? So, you know, I tend to sort of waffle something in response. But actually thinking about it, there are some parallels between the decisions then or the situation in 1914 and the situation now. Obviously, the Ukraine, for example, comes up all the time at the moment in these comparisons. And that is the complacency, or that feeling that war can't come, which Zünke just alluded to, these recent interpretations where war was seen as improbable, as unlikely, as impossible. And when I thought about that, I thought, well, that's actually what we think now. We look at what's happening outside of Europe, but we think, but Europe is not going to fight each other. We're not going to be in a war. And that was, of course, exactly what people thought at the time, because they had a long history of peace, just as we do now. And there was, in that sense, among certain people, a sense that this war might not come. And, of course, there was, among other people, a real desire to have that war. So that just brings me to a brief conclusion as to what is left to argue about, and I needed a slightly bigger sticky note for that. I think there's still quite a bit to argue about. So plenty. Most of it, I think, or a lot of it, is counterfactual, but nonetheless, it is, of course, what we argue about. And so I've jotted down here the point already made by John earlier. Did Britain fight the wrong war? Should Britain have stayed out of the war? It is an important question because it is about whether all these sacrifices were in vain, whether a different decision could have been reached by the British government. And I think it is a valid question to ask. A question about Austria-Hungary. Would it have been doomed if it had settled for a diplomatic victory in 1914? Were the Austrian and Hungarian politicians right to think that only a war could save Austria-Hungary from its predicted demise? France and Russia, Zuncker just mentioned that. What did they agree during the July crisis? And does it matter what they agreed? So Edward Grey's mediation proposal, was it sincere or not? It's recently been questioned by Chris Clark whether or not he actually made these mediation proposals in an honest way, which I think until that point most people had never questioned. Germany, would Germany have actually become a Weltmacht anyway, as many of its industrialists said? It was going to become the foremost power without a war. The question that I raised, was war unavoidable? Was it likely? Was it improbable? That's still an open question, I think, for us today. Also, we could ask about Serbia's involvement in the assassination, as was just mentioned. And there are questions around commemoration. It's very interesting if you look at how different countries commemorate the war and look at the origins of the war. Why is that so different? And as I said, you know, how much longer will we actually argue about this, and will this ever go away? And just to finish, I think that the continued and continuing politicization of the debate and the instrumentalization of the topic means that 100 years on, that it is just as politically explosive as it was in 1914. And I don't know when that will end. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm in the very happy position of speaking last, so everyone said everything, except I have got a few things I'd like to add. It is, I think, something that remains a huge question or series of questions, partly because the consequences and scope and length of the war were so catastrophic and left such huge changes behind them. I think we are fairly clear about what we have in the way of evidence and what we don't. There are no caches of evidence waiting to be discovered. What is the problem, of course, with the evidence is how to read it, how to read words that were spoken at the time, what those words mean. Just to give you one example, people in Europe in the 19th century and early 20th century often talked about race when they meant nation, and simply being able to understand the ways in which words were used in their context at the time, I think, is always going to be a challenge for later historians. We have a great many memoirs about the First World War, and of course they're highly unreliable because people rushed almost as soon as the war began to show that they had been right and everyone else had been wrong. And so it's very difficult to take these as evidence of what people are actually thinking and doing at the time. There are some things I think we'll never know. Samuel Williamson and Ernest May had a very good article on this a few years ago and pointed to some of the gaps in our knowledge, very important gaps, which I think are unlikely to be filled. I mean, others have referred to the meetings between the French president and prime minister, between Poincaré and Viviani, when they went to St. Petersburg in late July 1914. And we just don't know what was said at those meetings. We have various reports. There are reports sent back to Paris by a military attaché who wasn't at the meetings but probably picked up various pieces of them. There are the highly unreliable reports of Maurice Paléologue, the French ambassador, who I think made up things when he didn't have answers. And so we really don't know what was actually said in those meetings. Were the French urging the Russians to get tough with Austria-Hungary? Were they urging them into a war? Had the French decided that this was a good time for war? We can't know, which hasn't prevented some historians from doing what I would call imaginative reconstructions. Sean McMeekin, for example, has written a book in which he says at least by my lights, a bit too often, we don't know, but it must have been the case that they said to each other, which I learnt as a young history undergraduate, you don't do, or you don't do more than once in a book. So we don't know about that. We don't know, and others have referred to this, just how closely the Serbian government was linked to what happened in Sarajevo. We never will know. Those in the Serbian government who were behind, and I think there certainly were elements in the Serbian government who were behind what Princep and his co-conspirators were doing, were very careful to cover their tracks. And the Serbian government itself, particularly the Prime Minister Nikolai Pašić, either knew or chose not to know what was going on, perhaps chose to ignore it. And I think very telling that during the war itself, he whistled up a very hasty trial of APIS, the famous head of Serbian military intelligence, and had him executed very quickly before much defense was possible. So we'll never know. I think we can suspect that there may have been either rogue elements within the Serbian government or people very close to the Serbian government encouraging the plotters. They had, after all, been doing this elsewhere. They had been funding and supporting terrorist activities elsewhere throughout the Balkans, also elsewhere within Austria-Hungary. So it's not unlikely that they were behind it, and I think we'll never entirely know. We won't know for sure what German military thinking was because a number of those records were destroyed during the Second World War. I think we again have a very good idea of what they were thinking, but there are certain gaps in that knowledge. We don't know what the discussions were in the British cabinet. There were no records kept at the time. Keeping records of cabinet discussions only came in during the First World War. We have diaries, we have letters, we have, for example, Asquith's letters to Venetia Stanley, in which he occasionally, when he wasn't asking her about her pets, occasionally bothered to mention the crisis in Europe and bothered to mention what the cabinet was talking about. But we don't have a full record of what happened in the British cabinet. And I think there are also people who simply remain puzzling. I mean, Bethmann Hollweg, I think, is puzzling. There was this side of him which was very melancholy. He just lost his wife. When he was talking to Riesler, which I think perhaps was reliable, he did talk about how everything seems really unimportant and meaningless. He was a pessimist by nature. There is a story that he never planted trees on his estate because he thought the Russians were coming anyway and he wouldn't see them grow. I don't think we know enough about Berchtold. And there's this moment just at the end of July where Berchtold seems, perhaps it was only for sort of public consumption, but seems to slightly lose his nerve and talk about trying to avoid a war. We don't know whether that was serious, genuine or not. I don't think we know enough about Sir Edward Grey, someone who was one of these curious figures who believed that everyone else was devious and untrustworthy and failed to recognize himself when he was behaving in very devious and untrustworthy ways. Also deeply suspicious of foreigners. He thought they tended, by and large, by definition, to be devious and untrustworthy. So was Grey sincere in trying to keep Britain out of the war? Had he committed Britain to France? It's difficult to know. He did threaten towards the end of the crisis to resign if the British government didn't intervene on the side of France. Was this something he'd intended all the way along? I think very difficult to know because I think Grey was probably deceiving himself as much as anyone else when he kept on talking about the famous free hand which Britain had kept and was something he kept talking about. So I think there are these things we don't know. I think what we also have a great deal of trouble getting at, and a couple of the other panelists have mentioned this, is the ways in which people were thinking. And James Joel had this wonderful phrase, unspoken assumptions. How do we get at the mental frameworks of people in a very different age from our own? How do we understand what they mean by certain words? How do we understand the ways in which groups think and interact with each other? How important, for example, was the fact that in some countries the upper levels of the Foreign Service tended to come from a particular social class? How important are the values of that social class? How important are notions of honor? How important are notions of manliness? I mean, how important is it when Bethmann Hollweg says something like, if Germany doesn't react this time, it will be an act of self-castration? How do we interpret things like this? And I think this is where historians have been doing some interesting work. We're not discovering new caches of archives and documents, but I think what has been happening is more of an exploration, as Annika was mentioning, into gender history, into ways of thinking, into ways in which groups thought, into ways in which people had certain ways in which they viewed the world, certain assumptions with which they viewed the world. I mean, I'm finding some of the research that's been done into systems of thought like social Darwinism interesting, because it seems to me to inform so much of the thinking of key figures at the time. And so I think there are ways in which we can begin to get more at the mental frameworks and values and attitudes of people, even if we're not going to find smoking guns or bits of evidence. And so I do think there are still ways in which we can explore the issue. There's still questions, I think, which we keep asking, and others have raised some of these questions, but I'd like to just mention some of the ones which we still debate. Could Britain have done more to prevent a war? Should Grey have become more gripped of the crisis earlier on? And was there carelessness on the part of the British who refused to intervene and refused to make it clear what they were going to do? I mean, these are, I think, very important questions. If Britain had made it clear earlier on that it would intervene if Germany attacked France, would it actually have made a difference? And again, I think we don't know, because there were those in Germany who said the British army is negligible, we'll simply brush it aside and we can fight it with one hand tied behind our backs. There were those who seriously worried about Britain coming into the war and the impact of a naval blockade, for example. Do we know enough about the role of France? Was France acting to stir things up? Were the French bent on revenge ever since 1870, 71? And did they, in fact, help to create the world in which, and the atmosphere in which Germany felt itself to be encircled? And how much responsibility do we have to assign to the French? I mean, it seems to me that these are important questions. How important were the fears of ruling elites in certain countries that there might be social revolution? I mean, how important is in this old argument that really the causes of the First World War lie in the domestic scene rather than in the international scene? I mean, I think these are still important questions. I mean, you do get, I think, a feeling when you look at what people in Austria-Hungary were saying, almost a sense that we have to gamble, because if we don't take this gamble, we won't survive anyway, and so that we should actually go down fighting. It's the only chance we have. How much did the military agree on the nature of the coming war? Did they think it would be a short war? Did they think it would be a long war? I mean, the evidence, it seems to me, is still quite mixed on that. I mean, there were those who spoke gloomily about a war that was going to last for a long time. But then you look at the military plans, and they were all predicated on short campaigns, decisive victories, getting it over by the end of the year. Were they at the same time holding both ideas? I mean, do you have people fearing a long war but hoping for a short war? I mean, sometimes when you look at the attitudes of those who were making the decisions in 1914, they really seem to me to be like gamblers, saying we're in an awful situation, but let's roll the dice once more and we may get out of the particular trap we find ourselves in. Would the situation have been different? If Europe had avoided that crisis in 1914, would the situation have been different in 1915? I think it's a question worth asking. I mean, was the single act by Princep something which allowed Austria-Hungary to take a step that it had already been contemplating, or at least certain people had been contemplating, of trying to destroy Serbia or at least bring Serbia under control? Without that act in Sarajevo, would it have been possible for Austria-Hungary to move in that way? And would it have been possible for them to get the support of Hungary, as they eventually did? Would it have been possible for them to get the support of Germany? We don't know. I think what we do know is that the alliance system might have looked very different by 1915. And the British Foreign Office was very concerned by 1914 that the agreement with Russia was not going to hold. And there were real tensions in Persia over control of Persia. There was a great deal of concern that by 1915, Britain and Russia would not be able to get an agreement on colonial issues and that they would be on the outs. So if Europe had avoided this crisis in 1914, would it have somehow managed to stagger through into 1915? It had avoided previous crises. I mean, I think we always have to remember that. And I want to end with not a defense, but Professor Roll has perhaps rightly castigated us from not coming up with clear answers about how the war broke out. What I want to do is ask the question, is there an answer at all? Is it possible to get an answer? Trying to deal with the First World War is like, I've often thought, dealing with a sort of complex chess game on many levels, where you move a pawn on one level and things happen on other levels. And it seems to me that timing is so important. And in the end, the personalities of those who are in power are so important. Given a different set of timings, given a different set of personalities, was the war absolutely going to happen? I don't think it was. And so when people ask me, and Annika mentioned this, people ask me, could you explain in one sentence why the First World War started? My answer is no. I can't. The closest I can come, and that we may have to accept this, but I think we'll continue to struggle against it. I think the closest I can come is to say it was like a perfect storm. It was a combination of factors which happened to come together at a particular time in a particular order. which created the catastrophe, which is not a comforting thought, but it's the best I can do. Thanks.
What I propose to do now, I think, is let speakers possibly make further arguments in respect of other speakers' arguments, if that's possible. I don't know, Zilke, do you want to start?
Yeah.
Or we can proceed.
If I may. I want to underline this point that it's possibly not possible to find a clear answer. And sometimes we historians are driven, sometimes also by the public and by journalists, to say, come on, give an answer quick, 1 minute, 30 seconds. And so we try to do this. And sometimes we even pressed in our undergraduate teaching to say, you know, what's the headline? And so to give a very simple answer. And I think we should dare to say we don't know. And possibly that particular incident is too complex. And maybe there is a reason for that we have 25,000 books and articles, and we even could not agree on that. Just giving that phenomenon, I think, well, there are different opinions on the market, you have arguments for this and that direction, and I think we should possibly accept that even when political frames changing, when different cohorts get their positions in the academics, they find different answers. And I think I also have a problem with saying that they sleepwalk into the war. I don't think that they sleepwalk into the war, but I think still it's something, the impact from Chris Glassberg, I think it's refreshing, because we have a discussion on that, and possibly in 2 years we think it's all rubbish, but we discussed that, and we made possibly some progress in that. And I think as academics, we must question ourselves. So there can't be any progress without questioning ourselves. And especially this is what I like in the British academic debate. You always have an Andrew Taylor saying exactly the opposite of everyone else, or a Neil Ferguson saying exactly the opposite of someone else. And this might be over-exaggerated, yes, of course, and there might be a reason for that, and a good financial reason, possibly. But It forces us to make a point and even argue against it. And then thereby, I think, the whole knowledge and the whole debate can move a step forward. If we all agree, yes, the Germans planned in 1912, it's the Germans who were, yeah, we can stop that. But we know, I think it's too complicated for them. So I think, I would absolutely agree to John Grill. It's a bit a pity that we have these national stereotypes, especially in the audience, in the media, and it's sometimes ridiculous for us academics to see, you know, it's not that simple. But I think we must somehow persuade a wider public, journalists, our students, there is no clear answer to that. There are many clear answers to other questions in history, outbreak of the Second World War, whatever. But possibly we won't find an answer to that. And we should dare to say this. Why not? Why not? It's too complicated, possibly. And I would underline that argument. And the other thing is, I think, which was mentioned before, very interesting, we deal with human beings. But we are not social psychologists. So sometimes it's really interesting that we as historians act as hobby psychologists and say, you know, what might have been Bethmann Hollweg's perception of that. And I have once collaborated with a social psychologist, and there is a problem with that in this interdisciplinary research. But I think this might possibly be a step forward, that we have really an interdisciplinary approach to that, because we want to understand how people act. And there is a discipline working on that, and there's literature on that, and there are experts on that, and there are better experts than possibly we are. So in collaborating, and of course social psychologists don't have the background knowledge, and sometimes it's a bit naive their way of interpretation of these things, but it can be a way forward, I think, to understand the mental frameworks, the frames of references, and to give more a fresh insight why key figures acted how they acted.
Thank you. I think there was a smoking gun, or at least I think we found something that we all thought was possibly a smoking gun about 45 years ago. It was I who actually sent Fritz Fischer the diary entry of Admiral von Müller of the 8th of December 1912, which he then made the center point of his second big book, The War of Illusions, to the effect that on that day there was a meeting in the Kaiser's palace of the generals and admirals closest to the Kaiser with him, but without Bethmann Hollweg, that seemed to suggest that war should not happen straight away, but in about a year and a half's time, after the army had been enlarged by a great deal and after the Kiel Canal had been widened to take dreadnoughts. Now, this is still the most fascinating possibility to my mind, and that's why I think it's such a great shame that we don't have better sources backing that up. I recently was in Cologne, and I jumped on the train and went down to Karlsruhe, spent 4 hours in the Karlsruhe archive, and came back with lots of new information about that crisis of November-December 1912, showing that Bethmann Hollweg was deeply involved, Kittel and Bechter were deeply involved. Clemens von Delbrück, the Vice-Reich-Chancellor, actually said to the Prime Ministers of the South German states, who were summoned to Berlin on the 28th of November, he said, "I have my hands full preparing for a possible mobilization." So it's not as it's always represented, just the Kaiser going mad, and you could discount that. This is actually a governmental decision, or moving towards a governmental decision to support Austria, come what may, should Serbia not relent on its decision to drive for a corridor to the Adriatic. The Austrians were prepared to go in and squash Serbia, and the Germans on that day announced in secret to the South German prime ministers that we will support them, come what may, whatever the cost. Now, Annika said in her presentation that the current debate in Germany reminded her, she said it was reminiscent of the Fritz Fischer controversy. I think actually the reverse is happening. I think although in general, as Inke Neifel said, we should welcome controversy, I think the phenomenal effect of Chris Clark's book in Germany is to shut down any inquiry into such a possibility as I've just mentioned. The book has sold over 250,000 copies already and going strong. And the mood over there is such that I doubt very much whether it would ever be possible in the next 20 years or so for a PhD student to go along to a funding agency or indeed to a professor and say, "Hey, I want to explore the War Council of 1912. Would you support me?" I don't think he'd get the support. And so that's a smoking gun that we are not likely to find through German investigations for the next two decades or so. I think, if at all, we will have to look ourselves. And one of the places we could look, talking about no caches of documentation anymore, is, for example, what the French or Russian military attachés had to report to their government about what the German leadership were up to. And I don't think we need to know what all the generals thought. I think we're talking about 3 or 4 generals, and we know quite a lot about what they thought. And we also don't need to know what all the diplomats thought. We know one diplomat was actually heartbroken when the war broke out, and that's Prince Lichnowsky here in London, who called his own leadership gangsters and was filled with hatred for what they'd done in 1914. He was an exception, but it was only 3 or 4 diplomats in the Wilhelmstrasse who needed to side with the generals to push the Kaiser to one side once he had given his consent to this action. And the whole caboodle of tricks was on its way to disaster.
What to say?
Yes.
Another thing. I jotted down that when you were talking about, you know, what you, maybe it is just different, and I think in some ways I agree with that, but I just jotted down a question. I don't have the answer. Why is it so different? You know, why is it so difficult to explain the origins of the First World War? Why have we struggled for so long? And as you say, maybe it's just too complex. I think, of course, the problem with the debate as it's happening in Germany at the moment is that the public, the reading public, the nearly 300,000, I think it's over 300,000 copies have been sold. 300,000 copies sold, you know, the people who buy these books, they can't digest the 25,000 books and articles that you mentioned. We can't even do that. And, you know, we spend most of the day doing it. So the public obviously relies to some extent on what we all publish, and you know, they will read one or other of the, you know, 25 books that are out, you know, this year and last year on the topic, and they will take their pick. And one thing that's really interesting, I mean, I mentioned Google, the other thing I like to look at is Amazon reviews, online reviews. And if you actually look at how many people discuss this on Amazon reviews in Germany, and then here, and it is just extraordinary how many people get so heated about the subject, how much they know.
Is it surprising to you?
Well, if you look at other books, they don't, you know, they might get 4 or 5 reviews. But this, you know, there's pages and pages, people get very exercised. So it's a topic that exercises people. And in that sense, I think it is similar to the Fisher controversy. And I think you're right, it will have a lasting effect, just as the Fisher controversy did. And John made a very good point in an article where he says basically, you know, it can't be up to the public to become detectives and try and find out where all the documents are. They have to be able to pick up these books and feel that, you know, yes, this person has surveyed all the evidence and they're presenting me, in a sense, a fair case. Yes, there's an interpretation, of course, one way or the other. But some of these books perhaps don't give us all of the evidence that we all know, but the reading public doesn't know that this particular document, which we find incriminating, isn't in that book, for example. So it's a tricky topic, and perhaps in some ways it's become too boiled down, not least because it's got such a media presence, and as everybody here was saying, you know, tell me in one sentence, and even if you then give them 5 sentences, it gets cut down to the one sentence anyway. And I think what's interesting, though, is that there is a bit of a backlash now. It's taken a little while. And that when journalists get in touch with me, for example, to talk about my book, what they're actually saying is there's all these, they call them Weltkriegserklärer, someone said. You know, it's nice to see someone taking a different stance to what's here at the moment. So I think they're looking for different interpretations. So I don't think it's going to necessarily go just the one way. And just one point, though, on the dangers of the reinterpretation. I think it does matter how we explain the First World War, and it's an interesting phenomenon that in Germany people are so relieved, seemingly, to be rid of this shame of guilt. You'd think everybody had kind of got over it, but they hadn't, and now they're really extremely relieved and feel that, you know, you can be German again. And that's the exact opposite to what happened in the 1960s, where, you know, on top of the shame of having been responsible for the Second World War, now we have to shoulder that burden as well. And exactly the opposite is happening now. It's perhaps just one example, but there is a citation in the Spiegel in a 6-part series on the First World War earlier this year of the German historian Ernst Nolte of Historikerstreit fame, who is saying that because we're now seeing the origins of the First War in a different light, we need to also look at the origins of the Second World War in a different light. Because if Hitler actually realised, and he calls them legitimate Weimar claims in 1939 of Poland, then we need to look at that again, and perhaps some war guilt attaches to Poland and Britain. And that's where I think it does become a little bit dangerous. If I'm quite happy to have different interpretations of why the war broke out, but if we then use that to try and explain away what happened in 1939 as well, I worry about it. Maybe, but nonetheless it's in the Spiegel, and you know that didn't cause a big controversy. You'd think there'd be people writing in saying, hang on a minute, you can't say that, but nobody did. So yeah. But yes, hopefully it's just
him. Well, I think what we're seeing, which is always so interesting, is how present preoccupations feed in to what we ask about the past. And I think in Germany there's a sense that we've had it with being criticised and blamed for everything, and finally, you know, we can now come back to it. We can be seen as rational actors. There's a more balanced approach. And the Serbians are very, or many of them are very sensitive at the moment about the whole issue of the First World War. You've been to a conference there, which I failed to go to because I thought I don't want to go and be criticised yet again by Serbian nationalists telling them I should be fired. I think the Serbian angst over what's the way in which the war will be remembered, the insistence by Serbian nationalists that Princep is a freedom fighter and not a terrorist, which is one of the things that got me into trouble, is partly reflecting Serbia's own uncertainty about its status in Europe today, and the sense that it's been blamed, perhaps unfairly, for all the horrors of the breakup of Yugoslavia. And so I think you get present preoccupations affecting the sorts of questions we write about with the past. And I think this is, the First World War is very much caught up in this. And I think in Britain, part of the debate over the origins of the First World War is partly Britain looking back at a time when its role in the world seemed to be clearer, when Britain was a great power. And here you have a Britain at the moment which is in one of its periodic fits of not knowing whether it's in the European Union or out, not knowing what it is to be British, all this concern over immigrants and British values and what are we teaching people, and the very real prospect that part of Britain, the United Kingdom, may break away, leaving a very much smaller Britain, with England, Wales, and presumably the north of Ireland. And so I do think the ways in which these debates are being framed are often very much affected by what's happening at the moment. I do think, and I hesitate to disagree with Professor Roll, whose work I respect so much, but I do think the War Council of December 1912 does pose problems in that how do you interpret that meeting? Were they talking about when war is coming, or were they talking about if war comes? And it seems to me that's a very important distinction. And that to take one meeting as indicative of a plan to start a war, it seems to me, is problematic. I think at least it's something to be debated. And Bethmann Hollweg's reaction to that meeting, to which he was not invited, seems he was indeed worried about the possibility of a general mobilization, but he was also annoyed that such a meeting had taken place, was worried that the Kaiser might be running out of control yet again. I mean, this was always a worry for Wilhelm's ministers. So is that firm evidence of a German plan, or is it Germany saying, we're in a difficult situation here, how should we fight, when can we fight, if we're going to fight, should we fight now? I mean, is it in the conditional, or is it in the definite? And I think, the evidence of the character and the pessimism of von Moltke himself, who was in charge of planning for such a war, but who frequently expressed worries about it, worries about his own capacity to manage such a war. So I think there are grounds for disagreement in the interpretation of what this event meant. Is it a smoking gun or not? I think there's still grounds there for disagreement.
Yeah, could I just answer that directly? I'd love to. In this room, I don't know when it was, 3 years ago, we had a conference on the Fisher controversy, at which I presented a paper arguing that Fisher got the War Council slightly wrong. It was not a discussion about some future war that was to be had. It was actually a meeting to decide whether a decision which had already been taken 3 or 4 weeks earlier to start war immediately if Austria attacked Serbia should be rescinded or not. Mm. Are we really ready? And the reason, it comes back to a point you yourself made about British deterrence. Yeah. The reason the meeting decided not to go to war straight away was because there had been this clear warning from London that Britain would intervene to protect France from being crushed by the German army. So it was not a meeting deciding to have a war. It was not a single document either. It was a whole process. That ended on that day with even the generals reluctantly, but also Tirpitz for the Navy, saying, no, let's not have it now. Let's have it when we're ready, which will be in about a year and a half time, but who knows. So a very much less precise document, not even conditional. It's actually calling off something. Mm. But the factors which had led to that decision in the first place were, of course, still present in the minds of the same people a year later, or a year and a half later, when a completely different, well, not a completely different situation, but an analogous situation arose with the murder at Sarajevo. And it's very interesting that, I always thought that the Kaiser's famous marginal comment, now or never, let's sort the Serbs out straight away, was a spontaneous response to the terrible news that his friend Francie had been assassinated, but actually he writes that note 6 days later. Well, what happened in those 6 days? Yeah. The silence in the records. Yeah. But obviously, something is going on behind the scenes there that we just don't know, and I would love to know.
Yeah. Can I just respond? I mean, it seems to me that the two things with the Kaiser, and you know him much better than I do, but he talked too much, didn't he? He was constantly talking.
and constantly sort of trying to show that he was strong. But at the same time, as he's saying now or never, he's also talking about how I'm the only one who really cares about peace. You know, I mean, he's a contradictory character. I mean, the other thing it seems to me is so interesting is that it's one thing for the military to talk about fighting a war because that's their job. Mm. I mean, if there's a situation in which we have to fight a war, this is how we're going to do it. And what seems to be the real problem in Germany is that there was so little civilian oversight of the military. The civilians simply failed to do the job they should have been doing. And the fact that it was so late before night, so late in the decade, that they even found out, the civilians even found out the outlines of the Schlieffen Plan. We don't call it the Schlieffen Plan anymore. There's now been a book saying it doesn't exist. Yeah. But, you know, it seems to me that, you know, if you went to any military plans, if you looked at any military planning, you would see them talking about the war they're going to fight because that's their job. But in a properly organized polity, you get civilians saying, okay, you plan the war, we'll tell you when to do it. And it seems to me the problem in Germany was the civilians simply fell down on what should have been their job and they failed to inform themselves. And you can make all the excuses for them. I mean, no one here is, I think, but you know, the excuses have been made that under the German constitution they didn't really have the authority in the Reichstag. They didn't try, it seems to me. You know,
this is 25 years of the personal rule of Wilhelm II.
Yes, yeah.
But can I show you this, Margaret? This is the Schlieffen Plan, published in February 1914 in a French military magazine. It's not quite right because they don't have the German army going all the way to the coast.
Yeah.
But the big question is, why on earth should the French military be publishing this 6 or 7 months before the war broke out? I think it's probably to persuade the Belgians to get their act together.
Well, to let the French in.
I don't know about that, but... yes, the Kaiser is indeed somebody who says one thing and then he says another thing. I published an article in the Zeit just 4 weeks ago with a new document, again from Karlsruhe, from that afternoon that I spent there, saying that on the 10th of March 1914, reporting it on the 10th of March 1914, the Kaiser said, the British are so preoccupied with Ireland that they're not going to support the French. The French are so stuck in a financial crisis and they've got this three-year military service which they can't pull off. The Russians are not going to be ready for another 3 years, but I will never fight a preventive war.
Yeah.
That's what he says then. And the civilian South German who reports this says, we couldn't believe on it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And reports this to his own government, says, well, you know, the Kaiser has to be made to sign the mobilization, or not the mobilization, to say yes to this plan that we've got. But then we have to shunt him off so that he doesn't interfere again.
Yeah, I want to comment on some things, not on the Kriegsrat, but more on general things. What General Roth said about the German Research Council, I think the German Research Council would... I think you're right, but for a different reason, because the German Research Council is not interested at all in political history. Mm-hmm. So somebody, if Chris Clark had applied for a grant at the German Research Council, he would never get it. So if now somebody would apply for a grant to look at 1912 or so, they would be not interested in that. It's political history. You know, this is gone. This is boring. Something. And look at the program of the historical talk. So they're not interested in these things. So which is a problem, I think, in Germany then. So, because the whole debate is about, in the end, some kind of political history. My impression on the debate in Germany is, I mean, there are three big books out there. It's Chris Clark, it's Münkler's book, and it's Johann Leonhard's book, and with a different interpretation. They were all, I mean, Chris Clark is most successful, but they were all on the Spiegel bestseller list. German is a very different book market to the British one. The Germans do read books, and they buy books, not only with Amazon or Waterstones. So I think it's not only focused on Chris Clark, and also supporting Annika's experience. Some journalists realize, there might be others on the market, and Annika has published with Beck books on that. So I think it's still balanced. Some people are really shocked by the success from Chris Clark and say, well, it's... And I do have the own experience when Chris Clark gave a talk and I moderated him, the relief Annika was talking about. But you always had in Germany a proportion of the public who were rather nationalist. and in every topic. And you find these people mainly in the internet. And when, if we have the comments on Peter Grimmers and my recent books, I mean, a lot of shame came on us. And you find this community expressing themselves in the internet. And it's very hard to tell how big they are. But definitely they are there. You have even right-wing extremist voices. But this is, I think, nothing really dangerous or spectacular, because if I'm following the British discussion, if I'm following reading Tory papers, I mean, there's so much patriotic feeling in this country. There's so much patriotic feeling in France. So much patriotic feeling in Serbia. I mean, they hate Chris Clark and, for an obvious reason. So, yes, and there's still something of that in Germany. But also, we must understand the success of Chris Clark's book. The public perception is there was Fritz Fischer, nothing else, and now Chris Clark. They never realized there were 25,000 books on that. So, and Chris Clark and his publisher, or possibly both, are very clever to organize that. So he got all this press coverage in the main news and so on and so forth. So he was creating a wave. If Jan Leonhard or Herbert Münkler would have been the first, they would have got possibly the intention. So it was well done in terms of organizing the thing. And also, I think we should take it seriously that in Germany, First World War, it was about Germany, the books available to the general public. Chris Clark, for the general public, is in the end the first one who's addressing the international problem. For a general reader, it's the first time he reads something on Russia, reads something on Serbia, reads something on France. So there was very different to Britain, where you have a lot of books, a lot of big names writing on that, and Strawn and David Stevenson. So it's a much bigger topic for the British, and this is, I think, one explanation. And then it's an interesting catchword, Annika, the danger. Of course, when Ernst Nolte is possibly 200 years old now, and possibly not the most important figure, and the Spiegel loves to make and create a controversy. I think the debate is so interesting because it's linked to general narratives. So you have a debate on general crisis, and so this problem, how to explain that, but it's linked to general narratives. And then it comes to public and comes also our political attitude and living in a specific society or nation would in. And you have, of course, and that's the key issue. So is it one general narrative, and I'm exaggerating a bit here, is the arcsin of German history, which is the 18th January of 1871, the German Reich, militarism leading to the First World War, leading to Auschwitz, and the light comes back when Willy Brandt became Chancellor in 1969. So it's about the Orcs fighting against the Elves, about Middle Earth, trying to defend themselves against Mordor, which is Germany now. So, or is it, no, it's not that simple, and if you read Max Hastings, it's a bit of that. Or you say, no, it's yeah, we agree with the Third Reich, and I think I can see no danger that anyone, possibly the very, very right-wing paper, Human Flyer or so, they argue that way, but anyone sensible, I think, is not questioning that. But then again, it also linked to the debate on the German Empire. And there's a much debate on that, and even Dieter Langewiesche, there's no danger of saying that he's a right-wing person, saying, you know, it very much depends on your viewpoint, how you perceive the German Empire. The Seepunkt is quite important, and it's not a general narrative saying that it's bad and it's militaristic and all these things, and our knowledge massively improved on the German Empire. And it's, again, a very complicated topic to put the German Empire into a framework. And I would always argue against general narratives. I mean, we all have this kind of general narrative, to be honest, because we are human beings and we have a passport and we grew up somewhere and so we are not neutral, flying over the globe. But we should try to argue against general narratives, because this is what the public does. And we just have to open the newspaper, where you all find this centenary of the First World War. It's full of that, and it has its sense for society, but we as academics, I think, should try to challenge that. So, of course, it's more complicated. And therefore, I think it's a good, at least for the German discussion, a point where it's possibly more complicated.
But could I just say just one point, because I think it's interesting how you're saying how, for the German public, there's Fischer, and then there's nothing until Clark. And I think what's important there is that most people seem to have misunderstood what Fischer said, because he never actually said it was only Germany. But that's what people are reacting against in these reviews and in these discussions. They're actually fighting an enemy that isn't there in that sense. Nobody since 1919 really said it was only Germany. So it's, you know, it's a question of nuance, and I think at least since the 1980s we've looked at what was happening in Vienna and what was happening in Paris.
I think the people have a feeling you're absolutely right. You never said this, but it's then this is what also touched in your book. It's about guilt and responsibility, and some people in the end, even if they don't write guilt, they mean it somehow. And when you make the point in your book very well, I think, and then it's about linked towards the general narrative. I mean, if you ask Stigförster or Gerd Krumreich why they started studying that topic, I mean, they are part of a generation, and I'm a friend of both, and they said, well, we want to understand Auschwitz, and we want to, and Stig is always about the war criminal of Bethlen Hortwig, and it's understandable. And they lived in a different time, in a different society than I was born in 68. So it's quite understandable, so it's linked. So there is a reason why Stig said, well, I'm starting militarism in Germany. But it's also a reason why I, born 20 years afterwards, said, well, I don't care that much. So is there an evidence? And this is, I think, a normal evolution that the younger people ask different questions or have at least a less emotional attitude towards this. So, and you can feel these general narratives. This doesn't mean that there is a relief. I mean, and some people really misunderstood Chris Clark, saying it has nothing to do with Germany. And this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. And I would always say Germany is a massive part of that. But possibly we change the narrative, or we come to different narratives. That would be, I think, a positive step then.
You said in your presentation when you were standing up here that the majority of diplomats, as far as you could understand, in Germany were intent on joining this exclusive club of world powers. And you've now mentioned the big question of the nature of the German Empire. And Annika has just rightly said that in much of the discourse, public discourse, Fritz Fischer is reduced to a man who lived a long time ago who had one sentence, which was Germany was responsible alone for starting the war. And I've read in the Frankfurt Allgemeine recently the sentence, we now know, as a result of the works of Chris Clark and Herfried Münkler, that there was no connection between Germany's pre-war policies and the July crisis, and no connection between the July crisis and Germany's war aims. Now, I'd like to ask you, how do you imagine these diplomats in Germany thought that they could, that they were going to join this exclusive club of world powers if Fischer then comes along with an 890-page book stashed full of evidence from all sorts of sections of society, from the top down to the bottom, showing that the intention was to dominate the whole continent of Europe on Germany's part after victory, from the Atlantic almost to the Urals and from the Baltic down to the Black Sea. Then went on with his book about the earlier period, showing he thought that the origins of this intention was to lay back in 1911, 1912. And I just want to say that input of documentation, if you take the two books together, was, in my view, actually accepted by German historians after the Fischer controversy was run through, by Klaus Hildebrandt, by Wolfgang Mommsen, by Hans-Ulrich Wieler, of course not with the sharpness, not with the brittle nature of the controversy itself, but the general paradigm of 1870-71, Germany is united in an area between the Rhine and the Vistula that has been fought over for 500 years by foreign powers to try to control that area, because everybody realizes, as Brendan Sims has shown in his latest book, that this is the area that you need to control if you're going to dominate Europe. In 1870-71, you don't have a foreign power controlling that area. You have Germany itself controlling that area. Now, okay, you also have a Bismarck who says, whoa, I've gone too far, I'd better not go any further, I'd better think of a very complicated system to put the other to direct the expansion of the other powers away from the centre towards the periphery. But under Wilhelm II and after Bismarck's dismissal, that no longer is true. And there is clearly from 1896, 1897 onwards, with Germany's miraculous economic industrial expansion, a powerhouse that is growing ever bigger. And that surely is the root of the Fischer thesis and the beginning and the basis of that paradigm that all these other German historians, and indeed Paul Kennedy and other people as well, came to accept. And it's that paradigm that has been overturned by Chris Clark's book and Herr Friedmüntler's book.
Can I, I'm sure you want to come back. Can I just wonder if it's worth looking at the actual questions involved before we come to a discussion about what Chris Clark thinks or doesn't think. It's worth mentioning we did invite Chris Clark to this to this day, so there's a sense in which we're acting as ventriloquists and putting words in Chris Clark's mouth, and I'm going to do that as well in terms of the arguments that he puts forward. Perhaps it's fair to argue that my reading of Clark, anyway, is that he doesn't disagree that there were aggressive intentions in Germany, but he thinks that the decisions of German statesmen and generals were less important than Fischer and other Fischerites would think. And so that he instead has downgraded the importance of the original declarations of war. So whereas many historians, myself included, would have looked at, as a starting point anyway, looked at the declarations of war as at least a way of beginning to study the topic. It was Austria that declared war first. It was Germany subsequently who declared war. This has been downgraded in Clark's reading. He's downgraded, I think, the question of the blank check. If Austria would have acted anyway without a blank check, the blank check is an overdetermined set of actions. It helps Berthold and others, but it doesn't determine their actions. Thirdly, I think Clark has sought to at least reread the Austrian ultimatum and its significance. How important is it that Serbia responds to that ultimatum? Is there any possibility of coming to an agreement over that ultimatum? Or has Sazonov and the Russian Foreign Office already decided what it's going to do, irrespective of what Serbia puts forward? On the other hand, I think Clark has heightened our sense of the importance of the original Sarajevo crisis, the assassination that he has compared, probably to his regret now, to 9/11. And he has heightened our awareness of the significance of partial and general mobilisation in Russia. And so mobilisation is a key question now, rather than declaration of war. And of course it's Russia that mobilises partially and then generally first in a European context. Of course Austria mobilises against Serbia and Serbia mobilises against Austria, but this doesn't necessarily implicate the European pact in this argument. So it's in this context, I think, that somehow Clark can argue that he agrees with many Fischerites on Germany, but also agrees with a lot of the recent research, particularly by historians in the Third Republic of Germany, about Franz, Stefan Schmidt, or about Austria-Hungary, Gunther Kornbitter, and so forth. And this is part of the, I think, dialogue of the death which is taking place. Zunker, did you want to come back?
I mean, it's we can start an endless debate on that. I would definitely not support that FAZ article when I haven't come across that. And of course, I think you can't separate the time pre-1914 of the July crisis. It has nothing to do with it. So somehow the war came from the moon. Now, of course, it is linked. To me, but it's my personal reading, there's a major difference between the war aims in the war and the war aims before the war. And I think my reading, my understanding of the Germans, what I found in with the diplomats is that they were fine as long as they had five great powers. And they said, well, this Prussian trauma of being a junior partner, and from 1866 onwards, we are on an equivalent level with the other great powers. So we're a member of the club. And when Britain will become a world power and Russia or the United States were at least perceived as such, we said, well, we can't be just a junior partner of Great Britain. We must, perception, the power of perception. We must somehow achieve that. And this utterly failed, of course. And this put them, this is my reading, under pressure. And we know that this is bizarre and it was wrong, but it put them under pressure. We can't stand this anymore. We want to be a world power. We want to be on equal terms. And this then, you know, increased the readiness to fight for that in a given situation. So it's then the power of perceptions, if you want. And by the way, I think this is a parallel to Russia and China nowadays. It's very much about perceptions, about an equal level, and these kind of things. So, but then I ask, I can't blame anyone for that. I can describe it. But I think if you read the German sources, when for us it's weird knowing what came afterwards. But their perception was, you know, we are a junior partner of Britain, and I think there's evidence for that in Mesopotamia, for example. The Germans were not allowed to build the Baghdad Bund from Basra to the Persian Gulf. Why not, the hell? And these kind of things. So de facto, I think Germany was a junior partner of Great Britain in world politics. It was not on equal terms. And it might have been good if they have accepted that, saying we buy the world and we don't care. But the Germans was not an exception at the time, I think, in their perception. And Britain ruled the waves and ruled the world and didn't care about the birth and other things and other sort of, so international law, I think, was not very strong at the time. Yes, it might have been wise, and there were voices in Germany to say this, so you forget about all these colonies, we don't care. It's business which counts, but unfortunately, I think the Germans, I can't see that many differences to others. If they will come to an agreement, say, you know, we are trading nations, and that's fine, it's we have prosperity, and let's trade together, and we rule the world anyway, forget it. But this was not the mood of the time. And the Germans were no exception, but also the others were no exception for that. So you have a social Darwinist perception. There is this idea of there will be a clash between Britain and Germany, or Britain, Russia, and Germany anyway. So it's very unfortunate, very regrettable, also for the German side, but I don't think that the Germans were so particular in that time. But, I mean, it's an endless debate on that, but it doesn't bring us any further, I think.
Do you think that other powers would have threatened war to achieve those legitimate colonial and other ends, war in which would probably implicate the great powers?
I think yes. I'm not the expert on Russia, so there are other experts here in the room, but I think my reading of Zasanov was not that he was a quite peaceful character at the time. So it depends on the situation. And also the geographical situation of other powers was different to the German situation. The Germans had their own tradition, their own traumas, their own misperceptions as being the center of Europe. And if you have a look at perceptions, I mean, all thought, well, they are going to attack us. They are going to attack us, which was unrealistic. But you can find evidence why the Germans thought, you know, why Biedmann-Hobbit may come to the conclusion that the future belonged to Russia. We know there was never an offensive plan, but I think it's understandable. And I do think that under specific circumstances, other powers, especially Russia, were willing to fight. And you could argue, why the hell were these powers interested in Serbia? They didn't care about Serbia before that. So it's very much about perceptions, about prestige, and from a Russian perspective, you can understand that. So there is a history of defeats, diplomatic defeats, so that they want to show how important we are. Yeah. But I don't think that the German way is then a big. I think they're more on a similar way.
Okay. I think that's interesting. If we think of them all as essentially the same, and I can see the argument you're making, so they're all as bad as each other. But when it comes to who starts the fight, they might well all be as bad as each other, but there are those who start the fight and those who then join in the fight. And it seems to me, from the evidence we have that it is the decision taken in Vienna and in Berlin to start that fight, to have that fight now, that causes the war. And yes, I'm sure all the military leaders are all the same, and they all bring forward the same arguments, and everybody thinks a war will come anyway, and it's better to have it now than later. I can see that. But when maybe we do need to look at then declarations of war, and as you say, is Austria-Hungary who declares which declares war first? And we need to look at the decisions made. That's when it comes down to really looking at the July crisis. And the statements made in Vienna, first of all, that a diplomatic solution of this crisis would be odious. That is not what we want. So, yes, I can completely agree. They're all sitting there. They're all as bad as each other. But at that moment, in that crisis, which is precipitated by the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, it is those two players, those two friends, who start the fight. And, you know, a few months down the line, it might well have been someone else.
I would absolutely agree to you. I mean, absolutely agree to you. I mean, it's the Germans, in that very situation, we have the blanco check and so far and so forth. But there is a reason for that, because of the perception. Britain was in a very different situation. The big question, we will never know this, if Edward Grey would have been the Austrian foreign minister, if he would act the same. We will never know this question, of course. But, I mean, there is a... And there was no reason for Britain to fight. Of course, they had their empire. So it's a very different situation if you are in Austria.
1839.
Belgium. We can't come to Belgium in a way. I don't think that Belgium was Britain really cared about Belgium. So I think there was another reason. But this is another point. As I see. I would agree. Just the last thing, I agree to Annika. The question is, I mean, there was a different perception. A different situation of in Vienna, of course. It was a very different situation than in France or in London.
Good, I sense a need for questions from the
floor. Yes, I think you've
got it.
Shall we start with Belgium?
Yeah. Belgium first.
Belgium first.
My point is very simple. You missed the 1839 point, which Germany actually signed. It was Germany that crossed the border. Nobody else crossed the border. Look, if you go back over the period, the 1900s, there were crises. There were a number of crises. There were two crises in Morocco, stirred up by the Kaiser. All right?
Stirred up by the French too.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. The French didn't care about the Moroccans. They were not inviting the French.
I don't think the Germans were that nasty, but they were very involved. Who had a plan? Who had a plan to cross a border to knock out a country because it couldn't fight on two fronts? The Germans, the Schlieffen plan. Now you may not like the way the Schlieffen plan is dealt with by historians, but it was a plan and it was acted upon eventually. Now, why was the Schlieffen plan used? Previously, the rest of Europe stopped by deliberations the chance of a big war. And I've read your book,
You've got my number.
I'm a King's Military History MA, so I haven't got the depth of knowledge, but I've read a number of books. The point was, all these crises were avoided, and they were nasty, dodgy things at the time. Why did this crisis actually end in a war? My father fought in the First World War, and he didn't like particularly what happened to him and his colleagues. Now, why did it result in a war? Because it was the right time for a number of countries to urge their particular points. The French wanted, through Poincaré, he goes off to Russia, and he chats up the Russians, the Tsar. Other people are chatting all the time about, let's get back our country, part of our country, Alsace-Lorraine. All these things are going on. There is no one reason. It's too simple to have one reason. There are a number of reasons why all of these resulted in a nasty situation. What did the lovely British do? We didn't get involved. If you read the papers, we'd never mentioned it for months, weeks in July. There's a good book called July 1914, which is worth reading. Day by day, if you read what happens day by day, you see how interested we were.
Well, shall we start rather than going through all the...
Right.
Shall we
at
go
the end
to that
of the
question?
Day, it was not solely Germans.
Right.
But
okay.
They had the plan, they executed it. If I give points to whoever was responsible, I'd say there was 75%, a hell of a lot of other people really keen on the war.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say that straight away.
Well, this is not a gymnastic competition where we give points for performance, and I think, I mean, I don't want to make light of your points. I mean, I think one of the important questions is why this particular crisis at this particular time, as Annika said, and you're right, Europe had got through crises before, which it seems to me had left two rather dangerous lessons. One is that we'll get through it again, and so I think you really get a sense that they didn't take the crisis seriously enough in the summer of 1914 until it was getting really nasty. The second thing I think that happened is they may have gone further than they meant. We'll never know again. But what they had learned through previous crises was that you could use deterrence and bluff to get other people to back down. And they'd used mobilization as a way of putting pressure. They'd moved troops up to borders. Did they mean it this time? Russia started its mobilization preparations early. There's now controversy about how early. But There are ways of starting mobilization. I mean, you can begin to order more horses for your cavalry. You can begin to call officers back from holidays. So there are ways of signaling to the other side that you may be intending to do something. I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever come across, it's a great time waster called Engram. It's a Google thing. If you look up Engram, you can trace, Google has scanned in literally millions of books. You can trace through any given period of time from about 1800 up to the present how often words appear in books in certain languages. And the word bluff really starts to go up very sharply after 1890. And I looked in French, Italian, German, and English. Deterrence also goes up. So, you know, is there a dangerous game going on here? I mean, we can get into the actual crisis of 1914. It seems to me there's a dangerous tendency in Europe when there's a crisis to push it and to think you can push it and to think you can call up the troops, and that you can then sort of get your way without necessarily having a war. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't people who wanted a war, but another thing I think we have to be very careful of, we're talking about Germany, Britain, France, wanting this and that. These are conglomerations of people. These are different interest groups. These are different people arguing about what their country's policy should be. So in the case of Germany, you know, there were certainly those in Germany who said, we sit at the center of Europe, and geopolitics dictates that we should dominate the whole continent, our natural boundaries should go out and out. But there are others who said, we can dominate the continent in other ways. I mean, Hugo Stinnes said, if we just wait, he said, they're fools in Berlin, if we just wait, it's all going to fall into our laps anyway. So, you know, I think we have to be careful not to make it too simple. We have to remember that there are different forces within countries arguing about what their country should be doing.
If I could just add to that, it's a supplementary point. I mean, of course, Sazonov is arguing partly to convince René Viviani, who himself is resistant to Poincaré. Poincaré is president of the Third Republic, but responsible for foreign policy is René Viviani, head of a radical socialist government further to the left than Poincaré and so forth. So there are lots of internal debates in this context too, and it's difficult to make sense of them, but I think we have to. Does anyone else want to reply to
I just came back from talking, so
let's collect, say, three questions, and then we'll come up with the answers. So, yes, gentlemen there, and then there, and then there.
I've heard what you've said tonight, your presentation. Many of us here have indulged in action, but in the First World War, it must be remembered that young German men and British men no more wanted to fight and be killed than any of us here. And this was exemplified in the first Christmas Day, when each got out of their trenches, walked toward each other, and had a beer and a fag, and shook hands. Such is the friendliness of people who are not arrogant military and political elitists who get a lot of people killed. to achieve their own arrogant ends in their parliaments. Leave it at that point.
Okay. And then.
I'll face the audience so they can hear. It's not really worth hearing, but never mind. My question is really at a much simpler level. I imagine none of you thought much of the programme, was it 37 days the BBC did, about the build-up to the war. I found it fascinating, particularly what was happening in Berlin. That has always fascinated me. And reading books dealing with the period since 1870, it always seems to me that for all the great developments economically and in other ways in Germany, politically it just didn't develop. That what it did show in the programme was this quite elaborate system of collective responsibility here. But in Berlin, what came across loud and clear, and you can confirm whether it's right or not, was government was on a much more individual basis, almost factions between individuals. Von Moltke carrying on his own correspondence, Kaiser with his own view, Bethmann, Helvig, etc. And I felt that the capacity of the German government, such as it had evolved, fairly primitively, I would say, to deal with these issues which were getting more and more racket, almost like a piece of music, and coming to a climax, they were just unable to do so in an effective, collective way. And it was because government was run much more on the basis of individual personalities and because it hadn't evolved in a collective way. I'd be very grateful for your views on that. But what I'm really saying is that it was the inability of the government to actually deal with what was becoming a confusing set of issues, which have been very well and clearly demonstrated by the comments you've all made tonight.
Can I come?
Shall we have one final question, then we can take all three together?
Well, thank you very much for this highly interesting debate. If I may take, follow Mark's lead and put words into Chris Clark's mouth to stir up the debate, I would like to remind ourselves of one point that Chris Clark makes, and that's that looking at the events, we can't find one single gun, smoking gun, but rather smoking guns in the hands of every major actor. And he claims in his book that it's not even possible to assign different degrees of responsibilities to the various major powers. And I was wondering, if the panel could agree with this point. So do you think it is still possible to assign different degrees of responsibility and distinguish different degrees of responsibility between the major powers in the crisis?
If I could just respond to that one. Following on from what I said earlier, I think, yes, they all have a smoking gun in their hands, but they didn't all shoot at the same time. So it comes down to, as I said, who actually takes the decision to use that crisis for their own interests. And it seems to me that that decision is first and foremost taken in Vienna and Berlin. And later on, France and Russia do play an important role. I don't really see that Britain really can be given much of the blame here. There are smoking guns in all these hands, but as I say, they're not using them all at the same time. And I just wanted also briefly to respond to the first point about the ordinary soldiers or also ordinary Germans versus the leaders of Germany. And the same obviously applies to every other country. You're quite right that obviously we're not talking about all Germans wanting war or all Austro-Hungarians wanting war, and that the people who suffered from this were not necessarily the people who wanted it. And I think that becomes very clear when we look at more recent research into what used to be called the Augusterlebnis, the experience of August 1914, the idea that people put aside their differences and will rush to arms. That wasn't really so. And also, I think important in that context is that every ordinary soldier and every ordinary European at the time thought they were fighting a defensive war. And I think that is really important. And it also explains why the debate after the war is so heated, because, but I fought a defensive war. You're telling me that not only have I now lost this war, but I'm also supposed to have started it. You know, how can that possibly be? So whether you're right, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that ordinary soldiers and ordinary Germans are different to the people we're talking about.
I did see the television drama, docudrama, 37 Days. I thought it was a triumph of British television, one of the best things I've ever seen, considering that, you know, there are limits to what you do on television without losing your audience. And you're quite right that, of course, the portrayal of the German government as dysfunctional group of 20 men, I would say, who are actively involved in this decision, who are barely talking to each other. It's already been mentioned that Moltke has a Schlieffen plan, which Bethmann Hollweg probably doesn't know the details of. The Kaiser, I think, thought we were just going through, we Germans, were just going through the southern tip of Belgium and not going all the way to the coast. Of course, and the Kaiser is actually somebody who, to come back to an earlier point that was made about British deterrence, who, when he realizes that Britain is after all going to come into the war, tries to put through his halting Belgrade proposal, which I think his own government then virtually sinks and doesn't pass on to the right authorities at the right time. So I see the German government, I mean, I've been working on this now for 50 years, as faulty from the start, because Bismarck actually installed the Prussian military monarchy at the heart of it, thinking he would be able to manipulate it. But after his dismissal, it all goes terribly wrong, for reasons that are very clear from British and indeed American and other history, that you cannot rely on a hereditary monarch always being wise and clever forever and ever and ever. And we know that that doesn't happen. In 1888, a 29-year-old damaged person inherited this mighty throne, this Prussian military monarchy throne, and insisted on ruling. Now, he wasn't able to rule by himself, but the effect of that was disastrous. On the one hand, it was that you had backstairs influences on him, this clique of homosexuals who were manipulating him and guiding him through all these crises. On the other hand, he believed himself, with his damaged arm, to be a military man whose job it was to be masculine, more masculine than any other military man. And so he relied very much on the military as against civilians, whom he called eunuchs. They were eunuchs because they were for peace. And, of course, this went on for 25 years before you get to 1914. So this is the kind of government we have in place in 1914 when these great decisions have to be taken.
Just a very quick reply to Felix. I think, yes, I mean, there is a degree of responsibility. I mean, it would be a bit naive to say, well, they're all the same. Societies, cultures, countries are not the same. And especially the moment and the situation was not the same for every country. The question then is what you make out of it. And then if you put it into a general narrative, to give argument for your general explanation of German, French or Russian history. Then, to the gentleman that Germany politically didn't develop, and I possibly have a different narrative on that. When, yes, of course, Germany wasn't developed politically as Britain, for example. But still, again, we come to a point where I think we should be very, very careful of renewing stereotypes, and ending up describing Germany as a second Mordor or something like that. So I think when I overlooking the research on the German Empire, Germany did develop, of course, did massively develop, in various speeds, of course. If you're looking at the southwestern monarchies, or if you're looking at Prussia, for example, and the huge problem of the Prussian conservatives who blocked everything of the revolutionary debate. But, I mean, there are different narratives on how modern German Empire really was. Just to mention that, and possibly we couldn't agree here on a single sentence on that, but there is more out there, and there's more debate on the German Empire, how modern it was. So, I will leave it like this. And also, I mean, of course, there was a massive problem with
with the Reichsleiter, with the foreign minister, the general staff, the Kaiser, and so forth and so forth. But also other, I mean, in Russia also, it was also not on one hand, of course. And even if you look at Britain, I mean, if the cabinet was split, and the Liberal government, the majority of the cabinet don't want to go to war, Grey had its own narrative on that. It was also a bit problematic, and not on one hand. I would generally agree that it was a massive problem that the Kaiser was himself had a bit of an odd character, to put it that way. But
understatement.
Yeah. Well, we are in Britain, so we have a rather an understatement version of expressing that. But I just want to mention that I think Germany was developing and had very, very different speeds, and it was a very complicated construction, which is sometimes very, very hard to understand from a British point of view, and very different traditions and on constitutional levels, for example. And not everything and what happened in St. Petersburg or in Paris, very, very complicated in domestic situation, or in Vienna, not to speak, was so easy in comparison.
No, I was just going to say, it sounds like the coalition in Britain today.
Yeah.
No, that's all I want to say.
I've got a supplementary point, if I could, as a chair. I'm not sure I'm abusing my prerogative, but it's often the case that historians, and Cliff Clark is another example, that they argue that they want to avoid a blame game. They don't want to treat actors as moral agents. And of course, this goes back to, I think, a justifiable sense that the task of a historian is to explain why certain states of affairs came about. And particularly on this question, the moral prejudices and the biases of the historians have skewed and distorted the evidence and the interpretation of the evidence particularly. But I think there are two points worth making. This doesn't mean, I don't think, that one can't try to somehow adjudicate between singular decisions made by decision makers. There's been a movement back towards singular decisions, I think, over the last 20, 25 years. Somehow we need to link those to structures of action, traditions within foreign offices and within armies, and the conditions, the broader conditions in which these actors operated. Yeah. And this has been somewhat lost. Clark's point, I think, is that this is complex. We shouldn't ascribe guilt or blame because of the manifold unexpected consequences of different decision makers. So one decision maker makes one decision, and this puts another decision maker in an awkward position. Clark is not trying to argue, as I understand it, that there are structures of action which somehow limit these decisions in the first place, which, for example, Paul Schroeder has argued over a long period and argued recently as becoming probable war. This has rather been lost from the debate about moral agents or the relative significance of different individual actors. Okay, next set of questions. Alan and perhaps, and Tony.
Since Tony Knightson was kind enough to mention me by name, I'm Alan Kramer. I should just say one or two brief words about this. Partly it sparked also what Margaret McMillan said about the need to look back to James Joel's Unspoken Assumptions. I think it's a terribly important work. And what some of us have been trying to do in relation to the history of the war itself, in other words, to insert the cultural history of war into the broader narrative, is something that obviously we could apply to the pre-war history as well. And I think that's a terribly important point that you made. We need to know, for example, how do we distinguish between long-term predispositions to go to war, and many states, of course, have this predisposition to go to war and are prepared to go to war in certain circumstances, even Britain. Look, for example, at the war in South Africa in 1899. Russia, more recently, of course, with Japan in 1900. It's not as if these states were pacifist states by any means. So we have to distinguish long-term predispositions from short-term intentions to go to war, and what do states hope to get out of war in that situation in July 1914? And when we disentangle some of those predispositions and short-term intentions, I think we can perhaps get a little bit closer to a nuanced understanding of the origins of the war. One of the things that has come up again and again, not only in Christopher Clark's book and the discussions about it, but also today, and I think it's right that both Zunke Meitzel and Margaret McMillan have mentioned that we still don't know enough about the Serb government's intentions to go to war, or otherwise, in 1914. Mm-hmm. And that's why I read Crystal Clark's book with such great anticipation. Mm-hmm. And of course, the section on Serb history is very nicely written. It actually tells us nothing new about the Serbian government in July 1914. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if we go back to this question of predisposition to war, intention to go to war, what might the Serbian government have gained out of provoking a European war if we just look at it in terms of war with Austria-Hungary? One has to remember, Serbia had just fought two wars. Its army was depleted, the state was bankrupt, and Prime Minister Pasic was fighting a general election campaign. And Chris Clark makes Serbia out to be some kind of rogue state, ruthlessly bent on planning war. Well, what kind of ruthless state is it that sends its army chief of staff, the highly talented General Vukovic, off on a spa cure on holiday, where to? Austria, in July 1914.
Okay, turning the question.
Thank you. I noticed that, and I've noticed this for some time, that it now seems to be the received wisdom that a concern about the future of the Low Countries was no longer important in British policy. Well, I simply don't believe this, because if we look at what happened, the German attack, which was the result of the German planning, whether it was the same planning that had been there for a long time or not, it seems to me not to be particularly important. The fact is they had to make a decision whether they were going to, first of all, fulfil a commitment to France to defend the French if the country was attacked, if the Low Countries were attacked, which would mean an attack on France, or whether and simply stay out, or whether they should stand by what had always been the British attitude towards any threat to Belgium, for example. And I think if we look at what happened in the Second World War, we can see that they were right, because the loss of both France and the Low Countries meant that Britain was in a terribly dangerous position, and we were extremely lucky that some of Hitler's decisions were so bad that we were able to get away with it.
Could I answer that?
Okay. Yeah, that's
On this very point of the fate of Belgium, I mean, first of all, I'd like to stress the crucial significance of the breach of international law for the British decision-making. But secondly, more practically, and taking up Tony Nichols' point just now, the Kaiser actually, from the outset of the war, had a plan to depopulate the whole of the Flanders coast from probably Ostend down as far as Boulogne and resettle that land with German veterans. And I know this from Bethmann Hollweg's September programme, from the prologue to it, where he says, the Kaiser's been plaguing me with this idea for weeks now. He's writing it on the 9th of September, 1914. And then you think he's going to go on to say, but you know what the Kaiser's like. I mean, we're not going to... But he doesn't. He writes to the Vice-Chancellor, Clemens von Delbrück, this seems to be quite a good idea, and we must consider how to put it best to the French when we've won the war. I mean, just imagine that. Just imagine veterans settled on that Channel coast opposite Britain, 23 miles away from Dover.
I don't want to answer Colin's point. Final set of questions. Mr. Kennedy and the clubs.
I want to come back to your first comments where you said about the evidence being incomplete. And I wonder whether, as historians, you are entitled to draw any conclusions from the fact that some of the evidence was destroyed by the German Foreign Office, as you say, after the First World War. What can we construe from that? The second point I'd like to ask is perhaps a more general reading, which is that if, as many of the panelists seem to suggest, Germany did have intentions to become a world power, then how else was it to actually achieve that status, except through some kind of form of subjugation of the other European powers or through war?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, on the point just raised by Alan Kramer, maybe it's just me, and I'm a humble World War II historian, but I was under the impression that we had a consensus that Serbia, 1914, is a rogue state. No buts, ifs, or howevers about it. And that essentially maybe a dysfunctional and poorly organized rogue state, which just had, we heard a lot about the dysfunctional nature of the German government, all of which is true. But I don't see a contradiction with Mr. Dmitrievich organizing the assassination of the Archduke and General Rupnik going off to take the waters in Austria-Hungary, which is the case of the right hand not knowing what the left is up to.
I think clearly Serbia is a rogue state, particularly if you're sitting in Vienna in 1914. It's a thorn in your side as well. So, but Alan is right. They've just fought two wars. They are militarily spent. They are financially spent. It's not a good time for them in July 1914 to have this war. And I think then it comes back to, again, the point that Alan made, that, you know, the long-term predisposition to go to war versus the short-term intention in July 1914. I don't think that those members of the Serbian leadership who were behind the assassination necessarily planned to have a war in July 1914. They didn't know whether the decision would be taken in Vienna to actually attack Serbia as then they do. But they're not ready in July 1914 to go to war in Serbia. But of course, Serbia is not the only country that sends leading military and political decision makers off on holiday. That, you know, that happens very deliberately in Berlin and in Vienna,
in Moscow.
That's right. Everybody's in holiday because everybody can, you know, they can see there is a crisis. But you get these great letters back from people who are with the Kaiser on the Hohenzollern saying, oh, it's all looking a bit serious, but don't worry, you know, writing to their wives, this will blow over just like everything else did. So I think there is that as well. And just on the point of the Low Countries, I think you're completely right that Britain really had to support France and Russia in 1914. I can't see how Grey could have made any other decision, because the implications of either Germany winning and then being in the Low Countries, or France and Russia winning and Britain having left them in the lurch and then Russia turning towards India, as far as I can see, Grey is completely between a rock and a hard place in 1914. I can't see how he could have kept Britain out of the war.
I just want to make a couple of points. I mean, the issue of German power, Germany could have simply, by sheer economic growth, become a power in the center of Europe, as in fact it has become today. But I think it goes back to something what someone said earlier, and the importance of perception in human affairs and in foreign relations. I mean, what you think constitutes power. And before 1914, a lot of people in Germany and elsewhere thought that power meant having colonies and having the navies to get to the colonies to protect them. We now don't see colonies as being an indicator of power. In fact, we often see them as a drain. Which is one of the reasons empires were wound up so rapidly after the Second World War. So I think, again, it goes back to the ways in which people thought about their worlds. And if you thought that to be a power you had to have colonies, I mean, this is a sort of constant theme in German public opinion before the First World War, that we must have colonies because somehow it shows that we are a great nation. And I do think perceptions are important here. The other sort of question I think is a fascinating one, And again, this would be another whole evening to argue, is war aims. you know, at what point do the aims shift as the war goes on? I mean, the more you sacrifice, the more you pay, the more you begin to demand. And there's also this sort of phenomenon that happens that as a war goes on and you begin to think of what happens if you win it, you often pull out old aims which you may have had in your back pocket. I mean, you see it very much with the British Foreign Office when they begin to approach the Paris Peace Conference. They have a whole list of things which they thought might be nice to have. Suddenly they've got the chance to have them. Now, does this show that the British all along wanted to, you know, expand their empire enormously, or is it a case of war aims beginning to take on a momentum of their own? And, of course, the more you sacrifice, the greater the need there is to have some sort of compensation. So this is another issue, I think, but an interesting one.
I don't think that the German aim in 1914 was colonies at all. Well, not in the first instance, anyway. The Kaiser made it very clear, and so did others, Tirpitz, for example, that it was hopeless, useless, to have an overseas colony or a colonial empire if you were still stuck between France and Russia in Europe. So it's quite simply, there might be stage one and stage two, but stage one was to conquer Europe, if you're going to do it, and that meant, of course, crushing France and Russia. And you asked the question about the documents, the destruction and manipulation of documents after 1918. This was a massive operation organised by the Kriegsschutzreferat in the German Foreign Office, involving paying professors to toe the line, to sign documents which had actually been written in the Foreign Office as if it were their own work. There was a journal established which appeared every month for years on end, devoted entirely to proving Germany's innocence in 1914. This was all geared, of course, towards undermining the Treaty of Versailles so that you could undo all those restrictions on German power, which would then allow you perhaps to get back on the course you were on before 1914. And talking about the course before 1914, of course, the sensible policy for Germany, as has been suggested, would have been to carry on. They were so successful economically and in terms of science and every other way. Look at the Nobel Prize winners. You know, I mean, it was just, it's such a criminal act by their own government to decide the right way forward was to go down this track. It's a military decision primarily. Bethmann-Hollweg buys into it for some reason we don't understand. And one of the great things I would love to know, which we don't know, by the way, Mark, is what has happened to Bethmann-Hollweg's Nachlass, his papers. It's like we're still looking for the black box on July 1914, because we all agree that Bethmann-Hollweg is the riddle in all this, and we know nothing or very little about his real intentions. The best we have is the diary of this underling, this amanuensis, which, as I say, was destroyed, as far as we know, for July 1914 as well. There was a long search for it in America. Long story, a dramatic story, which I was involved in as well, but it got nowhere. The two daughters of the man who wrote the diary says, "We don't want snufflers here, go away." Now, I've got that in writing from her. My own letter sent back to me with this written on the margin. So this is some of the pitfalls of historical research. But what we have, and it's very interesting that three panelists have mentioned this in the course of this evening, the story of the trees, Bethmann-Hollweg's trees. I will not replant the poplars on my avenue because the Russians will be here anyway in 20 years' time. Now, did Bethmann-Hollweg say that? Did he write it? Or was this part of that document that the secretary concocted after he knew that Germany had lost the First World War, the whole thing had ended in disaster, and he was trying to rescue the reputation of his erstwhile leader somehow? Well, you said, what's the significance? I don't know. That's where it ends.
Okay, thank you. Zenke, final comment.
Final comment. I would agree to John to say, well, you know, Germany should have gone on like this. But again, the point is, we see this now, and we are living in a different time. And I think the Germans were not the exception of that. I mean, and all powers had this social Darwinism and blah, blah, blah perception. And if you say, well, the Germans should have bought the world, you should say, well, the Germans should be the exceptions. The Germans should be wiser than others to say, you know, we know war is silly and so on.
No, we're not talking about the Germans. We're talking about Moltke.
Yeah,
and four others. But we're not talking about the Germans.
be a bit Manhove possibly. So, so this is possibly the tragedy, but I think I see no major differences in that way of thinking. And then the war aims, just a few. Yes, when the war aims, we all know about the war aims, and this is, I think, the big advantage of Fritz Fischer, what he told us and very early on in the 60s about the German war aims. We shouldn't forget they were not alone. I mean, France, Clemenceau wanted to destroy Germany, the Russians were really heavy. What about Ottoman Empire? So far and so forth. So, so yes, there was a big debate, and Germany possibly not want to conquer Europe, but want to have a domination of Europe. But there were also others planning and drawing the maps new. And the interesting thing, by the way, is that Belgium was so important in all German war plans, and as far as I'm aware, nobody, even not in the Pan-German League, thought of Belgium before 1914. So it's again what was Margaret's point. So once you have it, you say, okay, of course this is important. The Pan-German League talked about, I don't know, whatever, but not about about Belgium. And I mean, I really like Georges Aristotle's book on the economic war aims. And the Paris Economic War Conference is really something very substantial to the wage of war after the war. And it's even gone much beyond Bittmann-Horvick's conception of Hitler Europa. So again, there's a debate, as it will be another panel, of course, what is the exception and what is the rule?
So, thank you very much for all our speakers' contributions. Next panel will be on... I'd like to thank them formally for their various contributions. That's an unusual way.